You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's been an effort to help college students graduate faster, but one possible roadblock, there may be too many choices of classes and majors. We'll find out why that could slow down the road to graduation. Now, the state assembly passed a bill last week that would raise the smoking and vaping age in Wisconsin to 21. That move would bring the state in line with the federal age limit that was raised to 21 back in December. And it comes in the middle of a surge in youth vaping and e-cigarettes. Donna Wininski is the director of advocacy, grassroots, and patient engagement at the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. Donna, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, people might think, wait a minute, we already had the federal law raised to 21. That should apply here in Wisconsin. Why does Wisconsin need to do this too?
Well, the federal law actually does apply here in Wisconsin. The legal age to sell tobacco products and vaping products is now 21 in Wisconsin. The problem is there is no mechanism in the federal law for state officials to enforce that law. So as a result, they have to continue to enforce the 18 law. The federal law gives that enforcement authority to the FDA rather than to local law officials.
I understand there was some back and forth over what all this Wisconsin law would apply to when it came to tobacco products, e-cigarette products, vaping. What, as it stands now, in what passed the assembly, what would this affect?
Yeah, it was an interesting week last week, that's for sure. It does include all vaping products now, all tobacco and vaping products, both nicotine-based products and non-nicotine products. And the other concern that we had was at one point in time, the law only applied to tobacco retailers, those who already possess a tobacco license. And as some people might know, vape shops don't need a tobacco license. They are completely unlicensed. So we were really, really concerned that all of these standalone vape shops, it couldn't be enforced within those because of the lack of license. That has since been put back into the law. So those are the two big things that we wanted to make sure were covered.
And then what would enforcement look like?
There is a program in Wisconsin through the Tobacco Prevention and Control Program called Wisconsin Wins, and they use underage youth and young adults to go into stores to attempt to purchase tobacco products. This now would go all the way up to 21, so that would be one mechanism. And it would also allow local law enforcement to literally stop someone that they see out in the open and say, hey, you look pretty young, you're not supposed to be vaping. The concern that we had with the non-nicotine products is it was always real easy for the 18-year-olds to say, oh, this doesn't have nicotine in it, it's okay, I can use it. It was an enforcement nightmare. And now just by making it a blanket coverage for any kind of vaping device or tobacco product, nobody under 21.
Talking to Donna Wininski from the American Lung Association in Wisconsin, looking at an effort in the state legislature to raise the age for purchasing tobacco and e-cigarette products to 21 to match federal law. We asked you about this on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We got a lot of responses. Ellen writes, I do support this. If it keeps one person from tobacco, it's a success. Donna, what do we know about the impact of raising the tobacco and e-cigarette age to 21 when it comes to preventing people from smoking?
Well, we do have national data that shows about 95% of adult smokers began before they turned 21. So that's a huge, huge number. If we can just delay the initiation to 21, it's virtually nil, so 0 to 5%, somewhere in that ballpark, that somebody will actually voluntarily start either smoking or vaping. So that's the goal. It's to get it out of high schools where the 18-year-old seniors can't purchase them for the younger students. It's to, again, delay that initiation to where the brain has developed enough that a young adult can make an intelligent, informed decision and will then make the decision not to use tobacco products. We know that up until about the age of 25, the brain is still growing, and the younger the exposure is to those products, the worse the long-term and long-lasting effects of nicotine will be on that developing brain.
We also heard from Emily on Facebook who says, if you're old enough to be considered legally an adult, you're old enough to drink and smoke. And that's a pretty common argument. You're an adult in many standards under the law at age 18. Why not leave that choice then up to that adult, Donna?
Well, we do. I understand that argument. And yes, we have heard it many, many times. You also can't drink legally before you're 21. You have to look at the overall public health benefits, and they are overwhelming. There was a study a few years ago from the National Academy of Medicine that if Tobacco 21 was implemented across the nation uniformly, we could prevent close to 250,000 deaths just in that population cohort that was born between the year 2000 and 2019. We could reduce lung cancer deaths by 50,000 people. Tobacco use would decrease by 12% in teenagers and 10% in young adults. I mean, the public health benefits far outweigh any other somewhat semantic argument for leaving it at 18.
We also heard from Christopher on Facebook who says, without government, black markets wouldn't exist. We see, now this is mostly with this these THC bootleg vaping products, very dangerous products out on the market. Is there a concern, Donna, that we'd be turning young people to illicit street products that could be even more dangerous in the short run than the current products on the market?
Well, clearly Tobacco 21 isn't the silver bullet for everything. What we are trying to do is just put another roadblock in the way of kids making poor decisions that they can't turn around. When your brain becomes addicted to nicotine at a young age, it can just be brutally, brutally hard to get off of it. And another thing that we have learned through scientific studies is more of those kids who are already addicted to the nicotine products will be the ones then who will turn to those illicit street products. It's very rare that a kid will go into that black market and try to purchase products off the black market if they haven't already been experimenting with them with just the over-the-counter nicotine products.
Donna, moving from the health side of things to the politics side of things, as we mentioned this past the state assembly, the state senate in this session currently is scheduled to have one day sometime next month. What are you watching for to see if they're going to advance this legislation up to Governor Evers?
Well, we have been trying to get an answer to that. Yes, it has been messaged over to the Senate. The Senate would have to pass the identical version of the bill and then send it up to the governor. We certainly would expect that the governor would sign it. So right now it is kind of resting in the hands of the Senate. The Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald has said that it could potentially be brought up. I mean, we are looking at that as an optimistic statement. He hasn't carte blanche ruled it out. He did acknowledge that they do have another floor period, as you said, later on in March, and that it could be brought up during that time. And that's what we're hoping.
As we wrap up, Donna, assuming this becomes law, what would be the next big tobacco control priority in Wisconsin?
Well, certainly we have been trying to get e-cigarettes included with the smoke-free air law. We are learning a lot more just about what is in the secondhand aerosol, the chemicals, the heavy metals, the other products that are just not healthy to be breathing in. And the only way people are going to be protected is to have them not allowed to be used in public places where non-users might be breathing in those aerosol chemicals.
Donna, thanks
a lot
for
certainly be a priority for the Lung Association.
Thanks a lot for joining us today, Donna.
Thank you.
That's Donna Wininski, Director of Advocacy, Grassroots, and Patient Engagement at the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. She was with us today to talk about the state assembly passing a bill that would raise the smoking and vaping age to 21. That bill, as we just mentioned, would need to pass the state Senate and then go to the governor's office for approval. Coming up, some college students are taking longer to graduate in recent years, so is too much choice part of the problem? Our guest tells us how many colleges are offering fewer choices to help speed things along. By the way, more than 2,100 listeners contributed during our winter member drive over the last week. Thank you. Your support makes the independent journalism, engaging conversations, and handpicked music you rely on possible. If you missed it, it's not too late to join in with a gift at WPR.org. And thanks to everyone who gave over the last week. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, roughly 100 million people who are eligible to vote in the 2016 election didn't. We'll talk about a recent survey that looked at why people decided not to vote and what would happen in American politics if they did. Now, there's been an effort in recent years to speed up graduation times for college students across the country. Some students were creeping past the four-year mark to five, even 6 years. As our next guest reports in a recent piece, colleges and universities are keying in on some of the reasons that can slow down graduation. One of those reasons could be too many choices on campus without enough preparation to make good choices. John Marcus is the higher education editor for the Hechinger Report. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, what's changed in recent years, John, that colleges are now seeing maybe too many choices slowing down those graduation times?
Well, a number of factors have converged, but the principal one is that if you think about the generation of conventional age college students who are showing up as freshmen these days, they disproportionately come from two groups. One group is students whose parents didn't go to college. We call them first generation students. Their parents don't really know how to help them navigate the very complex process of a college education. The other group are those children of parents who sort of helicoptered them through high school and made a lot of the decisions for them. So that means there are a lot of students landing in colleges who really aren't good at making choices. They don't have a lot of experience at it. And so while college used to be sink or swim, a lot of colleges are realizing that to improve their completion or success rates, they need to do a little more hand-holding than they've ever done.
And it seems kind of a paradox. More choice. We usually see this as a good thing, having lots of course offerings, lots of majors to choose from. That sounds great. It sounds like students in some cases are stumbling over that.
Yeah, so you mentioned that some students aren't graduating in 4 years. In fact, most students aren't graduating in 4 years. Only 43% of students graduate in 4 years, and 89% think they will graduate in 4 years. So that's a surprise that even further compounds what we all know to be the very high cost of going to college. You're not going to finish on time. So there's a lot of pressure on colleges and universities from students and their families to speed this up a little bit. So one way of doing that is to eliminate some choices to the extent that in some schools now, the university picks the first semester or the first year courses for the student. The student can choose the day or time, but not the subject. And the reason that they're doing that is that a lot of students aren't very good at picking those first year courses and end up taking courses that don't count toward their major. Instantly, they're already behind. They're not going to finish in 4 years. Other schools are keeping very close tabs on students, making sure that they're not falling behind. And if they do, the student gets a knock on the dorm room door from someone who can help guide them back onto the rails.
You got some response in your reporting on this from actual students in these schools where it's you don't have those choices in the freshman year all of a sudden. What kind of reactions did you hear?
Yeah, so surprisingly, I would have agreed with you that, choice is good. But in fact, many of these students were grateful that their universities had interceded with them and helped them get back on track. A lot of them were about to drop out. About a quarter of students nationally drop out between the first and second year of college because they just feel overwhelmed. A number of these students said they would have done that had the university or college not stepped in. Now, it's not really part of the historic or traditional university culture to do this. Universities have long been sort of, proving grounds where your success or failure was a measure of your character. So universities are doing this in some cases reluctantly. It's expensive, but it's a lot cheaper they're beginning to find than to replace a kid that's dropped out.
Talking to John Marcus, higher education editor for the Hechinger Report, looking at a lot of colleges and universities taking steps to lower the time it takes to graduate, try to ease it back toward that four-year mark for more students, and as we were just hearing, to keep students from dropping out, often between that freshman and sophomore year. John, another part of the story can be, as you write in your piece, changing majors. You come in, you think you're doing one thing, you flip over to something else. How big a roadblock can that be to getting through in that four-year span?
So many students do change majors, and some universities are encouraging them to pick a major as a freshman. Because, again, if you change majors, especially in some fields, you are already behind. You haven't taken the required courses. But it's not only that they can't decide about a major. Increasingly, students can't decide on a college. A really significant and surprising proportion, that is 37% of students these days, leave their first choice college and transfer somewhere else. And nearly half of them do it again. So people are going to two or three different colleges before they settle on the one they really like. And again, all of this, the experts say, relates to their inability to kind of make a choice and stick with it. So they pick the wrong college, they pick the wrong major, they pick the wrong courses. Colleges are now trying to correct for this.
How are they trying to correct for that? Let's stay with a major issue. How do they at least help that student figure out, hey, this is the wrong major during the freshman year instead of, I don't know, junior year?
Some take the kind of the softer approach of requiring their students to take an introductory course, and it's a surreal kind of an idea, but you have to take a course when you get to college about how to go to college. And so we visited a university in South Florida, Florida International University in South Miami, where all the students in the business school are required to take a course where they really hone in on what do you really want to do? What is the subject that really appeals to your passions? Because they were finding that students were really sort of cavalierly making these decisions. And that's helped. Their graduation rates have shot way up. So that's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is that there's a community college in California that now picks the entire first year of courses for their students, and they're gradually going to begin picking all of their courses for the student. The student comes in and says, here's what I want to do. The university says, okay, here's your schedule of courses, no choices. And so there are all of those kinds of extremes that are happening out there.
I got to say, I went to college a few decades ago. I'm visiting colleges with my kids now. And only now, John, am I figuring out what I want in a college in some ways. This is a big decision for someone to make without a lot of life experience to make it.
And a big part of college, and none of these people are disputing, that a really important part of college is discovering what it is you want to do. You may not know as a 17 or 18-year-old right out of high school what your major is going to be or what you want to do for a career. And college is part of learning how to do that. But when you come in as a freshman and you're picking electives that sound really cool because they're, there's something that interests you but really don't have any, ultimate practical use in terms of working toward your career or the major that you ultimately pick, you are taking money. Obviously, college has become extraordinarily expensive. Mm-hmm. You're spending a lot of money on something that isn't really advancing your success.
Is there a type of college that seems to be doing this, big public, small private, or are you seeing this in kind of all walks of life in the college and university world?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. All kinds of colleges. Florida International is a public university. We see this at a small community college in California. We see it at a number of private universities. One Catholic university that's all women picks all of its students' courses in the first year. So it really runs the gamut. Universities' motivations for doing this are different also. Public universities are often judged and even budgeted based on their graduation and success rates, so they have a fiduciary responsibility to do this. Smaller colleges and universities, as you know, and particularly in the Midwest, are facing an extraordinary enrollment decline, and so they have financial reasons to retain their students and to help their students find the right path so that they stay. Because they need that revenue. It's much more expensive to replace a kid that leaves than it is, and it's a lot harder, too, because there just aren't a lot of people out there on the market than to provide the support and resources to help them stay.
Yeah, on the marketing standpoint for a college, do they know what works better? Hey, come here, and we've got all these different choices for you, or come here, we're going to narrow things down for you and make sure you graduate on time. Do we know which is a better selling point for that maybe college that's struggling with enrollment?
Yeah, we don't know, and more importantly, they don't seem to know either. As somebody that covers higher education, you would think that you would be dealing every day with the smartest people in the room. And yet, even as they recognize that these that these choices are creating problems for their students. Universities and colleges are also really desperate to come up with ways of attracting more recruits, more applicants, more candidates. So universities and colleges have collectively, since of 2011, have collectively added 55,416 new programs. That's courses and majors. So they're providing more choices for students. We spoke with a policymaker who studies this, and he described it as kind of like a cafeteria where you can pick something from here and something from there. But as he pointed out, it doesn't always add up to a meal. And in this case, it doesn't always add up to a degree.
Has anybody been doing this, some of the things you've been talking about, long enough to have a track record, or are we still very much in experimental stages here?
Well, so we visited this university, Florida International University, which has seen a fairly significant increase in its graduation rate. So they've been doing it long enough, and they take the sort of the softer touch, where they essentially encourage students when they're in their first years to be more certain of the majors that they want, to spend a little bit more time making those decisions, and that for them has resulted in a fairly low success rate, which I'm looking for as we're talking, but a fairly low success rate up to a significantly higher one in a reasonably short period of time. So, yeah, it works, and it's logical. It makes sense. I would expect that you don't always know if initiatives that are taken in the higher education sphere are going to translate into higher, better rates of graduation and success. This one just seems to be a good idea. And I say that also as having been prompted to do this story after hearing some students speaking about this at a conference of higher education administrators. And someone asked them, what do you think colleges and universities should do to make it easy for you? And they said, to my amazement, they said, give us fewer choices.
John, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
John Marcus is the higher education editor for the Hechinger Report. He joined us for a look at efforts to help students graduate college on schedule, in some cases by offering fewer choices along the way. Coming up, 100 million people did not vote in the 2016 general election. We'll talk about the reasons why and what it says about our democracy. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, it can be tough to talk to kids about issues of race and bias. A psychologist joins the show with suggestions on how to start those conversations and to make sure they're productive. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, in the 2016 general election, roughly 100 million people who were eligible to vote did not cast a ballot. According to the United States Election Project, that's roughly 43% of the voting age population. There are a lot of reasons why people do go to the polls, ranging from maybe enthusiasm about a particular candidate or a desire to see certain policies put into place. But a recent study from the Knight Foundation wanted to look specifically at why people did not vote and what their politics looked like outside of the voting booth. And the organization looked at non-voters in swing states, including here in Wisconsin. Our next guest joins us to talk about the study, what can be learned about non-voters, and what impact that non-voting bloc could have if they all went to the polls. Philip Chen is an assistant professor of political science at Beloit College and an expert on voting behavior. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
Well, what was your initial reaction to this study? Pretty interesting study.
It's a really interesting study. It's a different take on a common question, right? We tend to try to explain, well, why do people vote and how can we mobilize people to vote? And I think this is a really interesting idea to say, okay, so what do the demographics of the people who are not voting look like? And we have sort of historically some ideas of what that looks like, but it's always good to sort of keep updating our priors and understand how these groups look like at this point.
They dug into a lot of different things, and they asked specifically, why don't you vote? Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of different reasons, but did some common themes jump out at you?
The common themes to me are what we would term political efficacy, right? Not feeling like your vote matters, and then not having resources, right? We've talked a lot in the past about resources being a way to get to the polls, why you turn out, and so that the flip side to that. But I think that efficacy, not feeling connected to, not feeling that your vote matters, really jumped out to me in the study.
Right. Let's dig into that. A lot of people, I think, might just do the simple math. I'm one person out of, you know, lots of people.
Yep.
Doesn't matter if I show up the polls or not. And how, assuming that it is a public good for more people to vote, which maybe we could talk about whether it is or not, but let's assume that for now. If people are feeling like that, how do you overcome that?
Well, I think the trick is, first off, civic duty. I mean, we can't base this idea that our vote matters off of simple math, right? This has been, you know, way back into the 50s, we saw Downs trying to say, well, we can't explain voting with math, because if we use math, nobody should vote, right? The chance of you being the critical vote is minuscule. And so we've added in what has been largely termed the D term, the civic duty term. And so to me, yes, absolutely, you can't just break it down to math. The question is, how do we increase those feelings of efficacy? And then how do we connect people to the political process to make them want to get involved?
Another answer that I think is related in some ways, but a sense that the system is rigged. No matter what I vote, there is some sort of predetermined conclusion by people, forces beyond my control, that renders my vote meaningless.
Yeah, and I think there's a few things going on with that claim. I think part of it is, yeah, maybe there is a tendency to say, okay, I've seen, you know, I vote, the same thing happens. It sort of goes hand in hand with that idea that your vote doesn't matter. It seems that, you know, maybe there's something about a two-party system. And then I think some of it is what we might term sort of rationalization, right? Saying, okay, well, why didn't you vote? Well, because the system's rigged, right? Oh, that's why I didn't get involved. And so there's a causal story that goes both ways. Some of it is actually feeling like the system is rigged. Some of it might also be it's an easy way to explain why you chose not to vote.
There were a couple different answers related to the candidates. Some, I don't like the candidates. Mm-hmm. Some, I don't know enough about the candidates.
Yeah. And I think, again, I don't know enough about the candidates is a classic resource story. And if we want to talk about the role that education plays, education is consistently one of the strongest predictors of turning out an election, as well as time, income to a lesser extent. These are the kinds of things that allow you to be involved in the political process, feel knowledgeable, feel efficacious, feel like you know something about the candidates. If you lack that time, that education, the connection to politics, yeah, you're going to feel like you don't know enough about the candidates. Again, whether or not you like the candidates, that can kind of, you know, that's a fairly idiosyncratic thing. I think there are plenty of reasons we can get into with that, but in any given election, it's hard to pin down exactly what's driving not liking the candidates.
Talking to Philip Chen from Beloit College, looking at a new report on non-voters in the United States. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions. If you don't vote, love to hear from you about why at 800-642-1234. Now, the why people don't vote was a part of this story, but they also looked at you know, what the politics of the people who didn't vote were, to the extent that they had them. And when we look at the numbers, not vote would have beaten Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump by a big margin.
It would have.
In 2016. And I think there's a perception sometimes that from people across the political spectrum, if we could get those non-voters to the polls, they're going to agree with my side and we'd win in landslides all the time. What do we see when we try to dig into their politics?
I think what we see is what political scientists have sort of known, which is non-voters tend to be politically disengaged. They aren't particularly they don't have an affinity for one party or the other. The parties may say, well, if we got them involved, if we gave them information, we could sway them to our side. That's a harder case to make than just saying these people inherently, because of some demographic characteristics, should support our party. The evidence seems to suggest non-voters are kind of all over the map and not really tied into any one political party.
And they also asked non-voters about a lot of different issues. And it looked like on some issues they were a little to the right of the voting electorate. Other issues they were a little to the left. So it might be that if every single one of them voted, the results would come out about the same?
It might be. I think what I would caution us to not take too much stock in issue positions and party positions among non-voters. What we know is that those kind of survey responses tend to be the result of party cues, of information that we have from our party affiliations, from the people that we talk to, the politics that we pay attention to. When you aren't particularly engaged in politics, there's a lot more noise. It tends to be a lot more noise in those measures. And so responding Democrat, Republican, responding conservative, liberal, responding yes or no on certain issues might be is almost certainly a noisier measure when we're talking about non-voters who are not feeling particularly politically engaged.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Hartford. Mark, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My comment was that I haven't voted in a long time, and I don't vote because I guess maybe truly or not, I've been under this impression that it increases your chances of being called for jury duty. And I've also heard that jury duty doesn't pay well. And as a millennial that's living pretty close to paycheck to paycheck, I can't afford to do that. And so even though I'm pretty fired up about some of the candidates and stuff this year, it just makes me nervous. I don't know if there's any truth to that, though.
Mark, thanks for the call. I want to say in the results, the survey results of why people didn't vote, jury duty, fear of jury duty was up there. I think it was 7 or 8%, something like that. That's keeping a significant number of people like Mark away from the polls.
Yeah, I don't believe there's any connection between turnout and being called for jury duty. I believe that list is drawn from a number of other sources in the state. I don't know the specifics of how the jury duty list is drawn, but it most definitely is not weighted by whether or not you voted. So you can rest assured that if you vote, you're not in. I don't see any reason that that's increasing your chances of being called for jury duty. I think it's a subject for a different time whether jury duty should be paid in such a way to allow for more widespread participation, but I don't think there's any evidence that suggests that simply turning out to vote is going to radically increase your chances. I don't think there's any kind of weighting in jury duty.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call, and I think you've inspired a future segment on Central Time looking at jury duty, what goes into it, and how people get selected. Thanks a lot for calling in. Well, I kind of teased the question, and it's definitely a value judgment. How do we evaluate that? The premise I gave earlier, it is better if more people vote. Is that in and of itself a good thing?
I think, there's no denying that ideally we want people to go vote, right? That the more people who decide to go vote, that's a good testament to the health of our democratic system, right? If more people feel that their vote matters, that they are engaged in politics, that they want to make a difference, that they want to have a say in the process, that's a good thing about the health of our democratic system, regardless of outcomes. So even if all we did was inspire these 100 million people to go out and vote by saying, listen, you do have a say in the process, if it doesn't sway the effect of the election, the outcome of the election at all, it's still a good thing if people have more faith in the democratic system, right? Faith in democracy, legitimacy of the system is what keeps the system going, right? We rely on that. And so it's a little bit of a dodge of the question, but to say what we really care about is that kind of legitimacy or faith in the system.
We're talking to Philip Chen, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. He's with us to talk about a recent Knight Foundation study that examined why people who are eligible to vote decide not to participate in elections, like numbers like 100 million in the last election, the last presidential election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the state of voting? If you vote, what brings you to the polls? If you don't vote, we'd like to hear from you with your reasons for not voting. Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about why people who are able to vote ultimately don't. In 2016, it's estimated that more than 100 million people who were eligible to cast a ballot did not in the presidential election. Our guest is Philip Chen, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tell us why you do or don't vote. Back to your calls now. Anthony is with us in Oshkosh. Anthony, hi.
Good evening, Rob. So one of the reasons I don't vote or I haven't voted, I'm 22 right now, so the last election was the last one, is just because the divided red-blue Republican-Democrat sided sort of thing. A lot of views aren't represented, such as the Libertarian Party. A lot of people feel that even just voting for them, it just sort of get canceled out. And the mainstream media, they typically cover Democrat or Republican, nothing in between. So that's what I think is why a good number of people don't just show up.
Anthony, thanks a lot for the call. And that's a complaint I hear fairly often, Philip. You have to take a set menu. Mm-hmm. If you think of this one thing and you want Republicans for that, you have to accept all the other stuff. Same if you're voting Democratic. We don't have that multi-party democracy where we can find a party that fits us better.
Right. And I think Anthony is touching on that idea of efficacy, right? That my vote doesn't matter or that I'm not represented in the system. And I think it's captured in that idea of what we might term internal or external efficacy. So, again, how do we break the party system? The party system is in many cases, in many ways, baked into the design of the U.S. political system. That's another long line of research suggesting that, you know, there's often sort of third parties that come into the system, but it's hard to create a true sort of lasting third party, given the structure of the American electoral system. Famously, sort of one of the only laws that political scientists get to claim is Duverger's law, which says, given the system of design in the U.S., you are basically locked into a two-party system. And so there's a lot of things going on. But I think that's absolutely right, is that part of that efficacy is feeling that you aren't represented by the parties.
Thanks for the call. Go now to Leslie in Green Bay. Leslie, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us, Leslie?
I've been a voter all my life. And yes, I've even done the jury duty, which I don't mind doing. But that being said, this is the first year I just feel like it's hopeless to bother going out to vote. What? I feel like with the gerrymandering that's in place, I feel that the way the president is taking all this power away from Congress, even if we voted in a different president, I don't think he's ever going to leave. I think it's just gotten to the point where it's hopeless.
Leslie, thanks for the call. And for various reasons, maybe not matching up exactly with Leslie's, or maybe a lot of people feel either a hopelessness or a disgust where politics is a four-letter word. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we can quantify that. Do you see that out there, though, Phil?
I think I do. And I think one of the things that Leslie touched on was this idea of gerrymandering, right? That as the districts, as congressional districts have become more and more drawn to favor either certain parties or incumbents, if you feel like if you really want your vote to matter, it's hard to matter when the districts are drawn to be so consistently favoring one party or the incumbents. And so I would say that I think she's touched on one of the, you know, part of that, like hopelessness or lack of efficacy. That being said, I would encourage people. This is not to say those these are like go out and vote. Like it's important. It sends important signals, I think, to members of Congress. It sends important signals to the president, to candidates. Voting sends signals even if it doesn't come through in outcomes.
Leslie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Philip Chen from Beloit College about a new study looking at non-voting in America, why people don't vote, what their politics are or aren't. Back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hey, I'm so excited. I couldn't disagree with that last caller more. I think these Trump rallies are going to bring out so many people voting. I think whoever the Democratic candidate is going to bring a bunch of people out voting. I think we're going to have record turnout this presidential election. We might actually hit 200 million voters. I say that because I know Democrats in Douglas County, northern Wisconsin, the last presidential race, we hit 65% voter turnout. And if Bloomberg or Tulsi Gabbard starts a third-party movement, we'll get even more people out voting. I think this is going to be a record year. It'll be the story of the year.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Jeff sees people fired up and inspired to vote, Phil.
And I think so we have competing ideas here, right? There is the sense of sort of hopelessness or lack of connection to the system. But what Jeff's touched on is what we know is actually a consequence of political polarization, is that the more polarized people get into parties, the more they sort into the that their identity becomes tied up and the more important voting becomes. So one of the flip sides to increased polarization has actually been a long-term trend of increasing voter participation. You know, we look to the historically what was widely termed the era of good feelings in the United States when the Democratic Party did not even run a candidate for president, and voter turnout was incredibly low. When people feel a connection to the parties, there does tend to be a increase in turnout. That being said, there are still plenty of people who don't feel that connection to the party, and that may be where we're going to get a disconnect between non-voters and turnout.
Jeff, thanks for that call. Time for another caller. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hi. I vote because it's just part of our social contract as citizens to participate in some way in our society. My suggestion is if you don't vote, let's take the voter rolls at the end of the voting cycle and your name goes to the top of the list for jury duty.
Kevin, thanks a lot for the call. I don't know, it makes jury duty sound like even more of a chore. But Kevin, appealing to that sense of civic duty, mm-hmm. our basic contract as citizens.
Yeah, and I think, again, this is what we know, right? Civic duty or, you know, some kind of connection to the what it means to be a democratic citizen. That varies among people, but absolutely civic duty is a major driver of participation. We know that. We know that historically.
Thanks for that call, Kevin. I want to bring up something that the report didn't look at that much. We're talking about a presidential election year. That's high turnout by our standards. Mm-hmm. Local elections, and I've seen, and I can't attribute this, but I've seen people say, wait a minute, the decisions, the local decisions that actually will affect your daily life the most are at local government levels in many cases, and we're even less likely to turn out for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is 100%. Well, I mean, what does it mean to have a decision that affects your
sure.
life, right? We can quantify that in a lot of different ways. But the things that you see, you know, potholes are not solved by the federal government except for maybe some federal highway funds, right? They're not coming, you know, Congress isn't sending people to come fix the pothole in front of your house.
Right.
So there are a lot of things that where local government or state government has at least a more tangible effect on your life. Turnout in what we would term sort of off-year election, not even midterm elections, off-year elections or non-false or off-cycle, so spring elections, dramatically lower. And there you see just a further deepening of the participatory differences around education, around income, around race, that play into who has a say in these elections.
And then finally, Phil, this is voting.
Yes.
And some people are saying, wait a minute, voting's great. It's one kind of civic participation. It's not the only kind. Don't stop there. Do we stop there? Are people less likely to be civically engaged in the other ways, going to a political party meeting, the city council meeting, whatever?
You know, I think we've always had sort of a pretty scattershot participation in other forms of political participation. So it's difficult to say, you know, well, we need more participation in this. A lot of that is idiosyncratic, right? If you're going to go to your school board meeting, you're not likely going to your school board meeting unless you have something that's happening there that you think affects your life. Would it be nice to have more participation? I think many elected officials would say yes. We'd absolutely love to hear more from our constituents. There's only so much time in the day. There's only so much time that any individual can devote to the process. So it's not. I don't think it's right to say, like, well, if you don't do these things, mm-hmm. you're failing your duty as a citizen. I think that misses a lot of other external influences on people's lives. So what I would say is be involved if you can, because it's important, and the people who are running for office and representing us, they care about, they do for the most part care about the opinions of their constituents, but they recognize that there are limitations on how well you can participate.
Phil, thanks a lot for joining us.
Anytime.
It's Philip Chen, assistant professor of political science at Beloit College. We looked at a new report on non-voters. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the internet is big. The internet is really big, and people in different age groups use it differently. We'll explore the online generation gap, and you can join in with your experiences and stories. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:15, two of the nation's biggest cell phone network providers are in the midst of a merger. Find out how it could affect your service and your costs. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news for NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we answer a listener question about police recruitment and the challenges facing departments around Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.